Welcome to episode 51 of the Two Chairs Talking podcast. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, the irrepressible Perry Middlemiss. Hi, Perry.
Hello, David. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad.
Ticking along.
We've been having some work done in our kitchen, and I have a brand new cooktop and a brand new oven and a brand new range hood.
Tried them out yet?
Well, yeah, but it's high tech these days, and you have to sort of read the manual three times every time you get before you start to use anything. But I'll get there.
We were both computer programmers, David.
We should be able to.
RTFM, as they used to say. But you've really got to make sure that you know what you're doing, because otherwise you could end up, you know, making a horrible, horrible mess.
Yeah, well, I'll learn. It'll be all right.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So what have you been up to? Other than that,
not a great deal. You know, usual sorts of things. Doing work for Standard eBooks and so on, but that's about it.
All right. I hear that we've had some people writing letters to us.
Well, emails at least. So yeah, that's pretty exciting, actually.
Well, that's what letters are these days. I mean, how many actual written letters do you get in
a month? Very few these days. But yeah, so we could call them emails of comment. But anyway, we were talking about this the last couple of episodes, and anyway, we've got a couple more. So I was talking last time about a book by a Polish writer called Olga Tokarczuk, and I rather jokingly said at the end that I hoped that all of our many Polish listeners would forgive my pronunciation of Polish. Well, we got an email from a Polish listener.
Woof.
His name, and now this is the worry because I've got to be able to pronounce his name right. I think it's pronounced. His name is Szymon Schott, and of course I have to hope, you know, I really have to hope that I got that right. Anyway, Szymon says, I subscribe to your podcast as an SF fan, but I was intrigued when I saw the notes for your latest episode. I'm Polish myself and a fan of Olga Tokarczuk, so I was interested in what you thought of Drive Your Plow. I'm glad you liked the book, and I want to commend you on your Polish pronunciation. It was very good. Bravo!
Well done, David. Well done.
Please. Anyway, he also mentions that there's a movie based on the novel called Spore, and it's directed by the Oscar nominee, I'm not going to know how to pronounce this one, Agnieszka Holland. Who knows if that's the correct pronunciation of that. Anyway, I might check out that film. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Not the greatest title, can I say?
No.
Because I really do like the title of the original novel.
Oh, it's great. Right, yeah, it's Drive wonderful. Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead. Yeah, it's great.
But Spore is a bit...
It's a bit ordinary. Yeah. It sounds a bit like a horror movie, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that exactly. So you never really know whether that's the filmmakers or the producers or the distribution company or the people that have translated it into English that have decided that, what a stupid title that is, Drive Your Plow, you know. that is actually an excellent title.
Yeah. Anyway, he also mentions a book called The King of Warsaw by Stepan Twardok. I think that's right. He says it's a crime novel, but it's crime as in gangsters, not crime as in mystery. It was a huge success in Poland. I thought you might like to check it out. And in fact, it was going free on Amazon Kindle recently, so I'm not sure whether it's still free. But anyway, it looks like it's worth checking out.
Well, we might both read that and see what we can come up with.
That's right. And the second letter of comment we received was from none other than award-winning author Candice Fox, whose book Gathering Dark I talked about in the last episode. It was terrific to hear directly from her, and we're delighted that it seems that she must have listened to the whole episode. Candice says, Hi, Perry and David. Just wanted to write in and thank you very, very much for your kind words about my novels on your 50th episode. Congratulations, by the way. You're very kind, both of you. I wore a big smile at your assertion that there's not a dud among them. And she says, I hope The Chase, which is her latest novel, leaves you both delightfully disturbed, although by the sounds of it, it'll be some years for you to get to it in your extensive to-be-read pile, and it's all too true. Anyway, in a later reply, she kindly describes our modest little podcast this way. She says, It's very informative, assured, serious, but fun and very in-depth, which I thought was a really nice little summary of our podcast.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so thanks for that, Candice, and we're certainly looking forward to reading more of your books.
Yes, well, it's my wife's birthday today. Happy birthday, Robin. And I actually gave her a copy of The Chase today. So it is now in the house.
In the house.
How long it takes for me to get to it, because of course she has first dibs, so she'll grab a hold of it first, and then we'll have a look later and see how that goes.
I'm
So that's
certainly
good.
interested to look at that.
Yes. Well, I saw actually speaking of somebody else that we'd mentioned on this particular podcast. I was at a function a week or so ago and happened to say hello to and shake hands with Gary Disher.
Ah, wonderful.
And he seems in fine fettle, looks very well. And I have heard from my source within text publishing that he has a new book coming out sometime later this year. So he does seem to be getting into the yearly run with his novels, but I believe this one's a standalone. It is not in the Paul Hirschhausen series, nor in any of the others, but we shall see what we get when it arrives. But anyway, there will be another Gary Disher coming out later this year, which is what I'm always looking forward to. Generally, he puts them out like a lot of other people around October, November, in time for the Christmas market. So that's when we'll probably be looking at it. But anyway, that was quite interesting. That was
Excellent.
good. Now, the other thing that I wanted to talk about. Oh, you finished with all the locks, by the way. Are we all?
Yeah, finish with the win. No more. That's a two is pretty good. It's a record.
No more. Ooh, it is a record, so that is good. So that's great. I wanted to talk about the 2021 Hugo Awards ballot that I mentioned last time. Said that it was due to be released a day or so after. Or maybe the day of our last podcast, but the day after we had recorded. Well, that now has been released. Now, these are the Hugo Awards. These are the, as you recall, these are the reader nominated and voted for awards in the SF and F genre. So that includes everything that you see, think might fit into the genre, science fiction, fantasy, psychological horror, horror itself. Any of that sort of stuff. Dark fantasy, grim fantasy. We could go into all of the subgenres all over the place, but there's countless buckets of them. So let's not do that. But let's just say that anything that we look at and think, yeah, that fits within the genre, it's eligible. So now, due to the change in the date for this year's Worldcon, which usually is in August or September, it's now this year has been changed to the 15th to the 19th of December, which I mentioned last time. Voting will now close on November 19, 2021. So that even gives you, David,
Even me gives me a chance
if you're a
to
supporting
read
member,
some of this stuff.
a chance to read it all. Now, the ballot also includes nominees for the Astounding Award for Best New Writer. That used to be the John W. Campbell Award, but was changed by the sponsors of the award. That is not a Hugo, by the way, but it is included on the ballot. And also not a Hugo is the Lodestar Award for Best Young Adult Book. That is also on the ballot. Now, only members of this year's Worldcon are allowed to vote for these awards. So you have to be a member supporting or attending of Discon 3 in order to be able to vote. I'm a supporting member at this stage. I can't see myself getting there
No.
later this year. It's still a little bit still too dodgy in terms of overseas travel, other than maybe between here and New Zealand, which my wife and I are hoping to get to sometime later this year. That will be about all we'll be able to do, but we won't be there. So you have to be a member of Discon 3, the Worldcon, in order to be able to vote. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole of the list of all of them because that would take up a whole episode. But I will do, as I've done in the past, I will try to read my way through the fiction, the four fiction categories, that is, best novel, novella, novelette, and short story. And we'll cover those as an ongoing thing through the year, look at them and see how we go. I know that you're not necessarily always going to be reading all of these, David, but I'll try and pick the eye teeth out of a couple of them for you and then sort of say, yeah, so I'll say, I'll give you a couple to have a look at. Absolutely nothing guarantee you that in the short story and novelette categories we're going to be completely and utterly wrong. I'm going to tell you that right up front, but we may be okay in the novel, and I'll tell you why. So there are six nominees in each category, and for this year's novel award, the nominees are, and this will be funny because we'll talk about this in a minute, the nominees are Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, one which we have both read, The City We Became by N.K. Jemisin. You remember that N.K. Jemisin won 3 Hugo Awards in a row for her Broken Earth trilogy some few years back. The Relentless Moon by Mary Robinette Cowell, which
Must be another in her series.
Yeah, her Lady Astronaut series.
Yeah,
I think it's number 3, but don't quote me on that. Harrow the Ninth, which is the sequel to Gideon the Ninth, which I discussed last year, by Tamsin Muir, the New Zealand author now living in London. Black Sun by Rebecca Roanhorse. She was nominated for a novel a couple of years ago and won a Hugo for a short story a couple of years ago. This is, I believe, the first in a new series. And Network Effect by Martha Wells, which is the first novel in the Murderbot series, which has had up to stage 4, 5 novellas. After a while, unless you write all this stuff down and keep it sort of tacked on the board in front of you, you have a tendency to lose count a bit. But anyway, the Martha Wells Network Effect. I would have picked 3, possibly 4 of those being on the list. The one that I think is missing is, of course, Kim Stanley Robinson, which I nominated. We won't know which novels almost made the list until the voting statistics are released, so that won't be basically almost Christmas. When the awards are released, they put out all of the award voting statistics for the winners and also for the nominees. But then they will also give you details of which works were nominated in which categories, and so you get a bit of an idea of how many nominations it takes to get you onto a ballot. Best novella, which is one that I generally think of as being, you know, pretty good in terms of the indications of where the science fiction and fantasy field currently sits. I find I've read 2 of these, which is pretty good, out of 6. The first one is Fina by Nino Cipri. Ring Shout by P. Djeli Clark, one that I've read. Upright Women Wanted by Sarah Gailey. Come Tumbling Down, C. Dan McGuire. That's one of her Wayward Children novellas. You've read one of those, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Oh, now I'm going to be in trouble. Riot Baby, Tochi Onyebuchi. And The Empress of Salt and Fortune by Ni Vo. Interestingly enough, well, 2 things interesting about those 2 categories. Firstly, all of the nominees in the novel award are by people that would be identified as women. So they're all by women authors. And in the best novella, all of them were published by Tor.com.
Yeah.
All of them. It seems that they, well, I wouldn't say that they've got a monopoly on the market. They produce quite a lot each year. These are generally available online at some stage or other, or available as an e-book for not very much if you go hunting around. They generally have sales on and you can pick them up. Now, as you recall, though, David, if you are a supporting member of this year's Worldcon, most years they end up putting out what's referred to as the Hugo Award Packet, which will include either excerpts or full e-versions of each of the stories that are novels and stories that are on the ballot. We said in the past that this is an excellent way of getting a look at all of the books that are there. You have to be a supporting member of the convention, and when you are, when they get the Hugo packet together, they will send you a link which you can then download, and you can download bits and pieces. They also try to have sort of excerpts or trailers from each of the dramatic presentations where they can, and if you go hunting around for the short story novelette on the ballot. Hopefully, we'll be able to put a link to the ballot on our show notes. If you go hunting around, you can find a lot of these are available for free for a short period of time, and you'll be able to read them online, which is
Really?
good. Now, I'll just go rapidly through because of what we're going to be talking about later today. I'll go rapidly through the best dramatic presentations long form. I saw one of these. Anyway, so first one is Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, starring Australia's own Margot Robbo. Eurovision Song Contest, the story of Fire Saga. Don't know about that one. Don't know anything about it. The Old Guard, the one that I liked, which is available on Netflix. Palm Springs, Soul, which I believe is a Pixar film, and Tenet, which is the Christopher Nolan thing that everybody says they can't hear. So the thing to do is to watch that with subtitles. That way you'll be able to figure out what's going on.
I'll talk about subtitles later on. Go on.
We will. Best dramatic presentation short form, an episode of Doctor Who called Fugitive of the Jadoon, episode of The Expanse, Gagamila, an episode of The Good Place, Whenever You're Ready. Two episodes of The Mandalorian, one called The Jedi and the other called The Rescue, and a two parts of a short dramatic presentation of something I've never heard of, She-Ra and the Princesses of Power. This is called Heart, parts one and two. I'm going to have to do a bit of research on some of these, but given that we've got all this time up until November, I may actually be able to get through the whole lot.
Sure,
You never know, you're
sure.
like in the big city. So
Yeah.
we'll just give it a try and see what happens. But I will certainly be reading through the novel and novelette and short story nominees when I find the time.
Well, indeed,
Oh, yeah, when I
indeed.
can squeeze it in edgeways, but there we go.
There you go.
Yep.
All right. So this episode, we're going to be talking about film and TV. Now, my problem is I watch very little. I've either for reasons that are slightly complicated, but yeah, I watch very little, so I'm slightly scraping the bottom of the barrel here, but never mind, let's go with that. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is a TV series, The Flash, in particular season 5. Now, I'm guessing that we all have a few don't judge me types of indulgences, which we where we just like to relax into something enjoyable without being too analytical about it. We've talked about comfort reads in the last couple of episodes. Well, the same applies to some electronic media, and for me, the TV series The Flash definitely fits into this category. It's a comfort watch, if you like. Now, Perry and I have talked before about how we each read a lot of comic books growing up, and how in both our cases, this was our early introduction to science fictional ideas like robots, space travel, time machines, parallel worlds, all that sort of stuff. And I started off when I would have been, I don't know, maybe 9 or 10 years old, reading comics from the DC Comics stable, particularly the Superman comics. I was really into all those Superman comics. But I gradually expanded out and just discovered other superheroes from their stable, called things like, Green Lantern, Batman, Green Arrow. And of course, eventually I got to the super speedster, The Flash, who end up being my favorite hero from this group, the DC group. All of this is a very long-winded way of getting to talk about the current TV series of The Flash, which is obviously from DC and Warner Brothers, and it features Grant Gustin in the title role. The first season of this came out in 2014, and they've just started to release season 7, which presumably they shot during 2020, which would have been very challenging given the pandemic. Now, I've been following along through all of these seasons, mostly by borrowing the DVDs of complete seasons from my local library, though I can see that you now can get them streamed from Stan and Foxtel, but I don't subscribe to either of those, so I'm still sort of borrowing DVDs. Much of the viewing time, of course, involves the Flash zipping about at high speed, defeating supervillains and saving people. But as well as all of that, this derring-do, there's some surprisingly deep emotional material in the storylines that comes up from time to time. For example, Barry Allen was essentially Barry Allen, who was the Flash, who's the secret identity of the Flash. Barry Allen was essentially orphaned as a child because his mother was murdered in Barry's presence by this mysterious yellow blur or mysterious yellow flash whipping about a room, which then vanishes away, leaving her dying on the floor. despite Barry's testimony, he's only a kid, of course. Despite Barry's testimony, the police just think that's just a fantasy that he's made up to cope with the loss of his mother. So Barry's father is arrested, convicted of her murder, and sentenced to life in jail. And it takes us a while to discover that the mysterious yellow blur was a villain called Eobard Thorne, a speedster from the future, who dubs himself the Reverse Flash. Because one of the features of the Flash comics is that the Flash and the other speedsters can use their super speed to travel through time. But doing so can mess up the timeline and create alternative, undesirable realities. Eobard Thorne, from decades in the future, hates Barry Allen with a passion. Now, at the end of the first season, Thorne is defeated, of course, but not, it turns out, destroyed, because he comes up back in later seasons, of course. So without going into any more detail, which, of course, is a great deal, at the end of the second season, Barry is faced with this terrible ethical dilemma. After his mother's death and his father's incarceration, Barry was brought up by Joe West, who is a black police detective, and he was raised with Joe's daughter, Iris, with whom, as an adult, Barry falls in love. So the dilemma is that Barry can go back in time and save his mother, he finds out. But by doing so, he'll wipe out all the life he's had since her death. Everything will change. His relationship with Joe and his closeness to Iris, all of that will be gone, and he'll be a completely different person. Nevertheless, he decides to do so. And the third season opens in a new timeline called Flashpoint. Things do not go well with this timeline, and eventually Barry has to try to change things back to the way they were. Obviously, I'm not going to try and summarize every season, otherwise Perry will go to sleep among other people. But I want to at least mention season 5, in which Barry and Iris's yet-to-be-born daughter, Nora, travels back from the future as a teenager to meet her father for the first time. The Flash, it appears, disappeared while trying to stop some crisis when Nora was only a toddler, and he never comes back. But Nora's time traveling, however, has messed up the timeline yet again, and as it turned out, she's been taking advice on how to speed through time from Barry's old nemesis, Eobard Thorne, who's in prison on death row in Nora's time. Thorne, though, seems to be friendly to Nora, of course, has a cunning plan, which comes to fruition in the final episodes of season 5. The timeline changes yet again, and Nora, who's no longer in the new timeline, begins to vanish away. And Barry and Iris have to cope with the loss of their newly met teenage daughter, whom they've grown to love, which, of course, is emotionally harrowing. There's some really good acting through the series. Grant Gustin is perfect as this clean-cut, idealistic Barry Allen. Candice Patton is very convincing as his love life Iris West. Jesse Martin as Joe West, Barry's adoptive father, is also excellent. And Tom Cavanagh is a real standout because he plays a wide variety of roles as various incarnations or doppelgangers of Harrison Wells, Barry's mentor, as well as Eobard Thorne, who's taken on Wells' appearance. Now, the contrast in season 5 between the characters of the tongue-in-cheek detective Sherlock Wells and the sinister, broodingly evil Eobard Thorne, it's really striking, and obviously takes a great deal of flexibility for an actor to do. I thought it was really well done. There's a lot of humour in the series, along with some very silly stuff, some of it rather cringeworthy. But there's also a lot of well-done drama and serious themes. And as I say, there's some surprisingly sincere emotional material, which never quite tips into being overly sentimental schmaltz, but sometimes it comes very close. Look, yeah, it's my indulgence. I like the series a lot, and I'll keep watching as long as they keep making it.
Fine.
But there are some things about the approach taken by DC and Warner Brothers which really annoy me, and I'll get to those when I talk about season 6 in a little while after Perry's talked about something a bit more serious. So here you are, Perry, back to you.
Oh, thank you. DC Comics, never really my favourite. I preferred Marvel of the two.
Yep.
And of the DC Comics characters, Batman was always always mine, mostly because I felt it was vulnerable, you know. Mm. So the major problem with Superman was that he was invulnerable.
And that's the trouble thing.
Coming up with ridiculous ways of different coloured types of kryptonite that did stupid things to him. You know, in the end, you just thought, come on, you know, we're going to go through the whole bloody rainbow here before we figure out. Anyway, so that was a bit of a problem, and they had a lot of difficulty with that. But anyway, Flash was never really one of my favourite characters, just the way that it is. I mean, we've all got our different different tastes, and that's it. I'm not going to be talking about TV at all today. No. Although I will say that, and I'm not going to be talking about Marvel superhero or science fiction stories either. Although I will say that I have seen the Zack Snyder's Justice League 4 hours.
Good grief.
4 hours. It's actually cut into six different parts. So you could actually watch it as six parts, and you could basically look at it as being a six-part miniseries, which they've just all tagged together and said, here's the movie, but you can split it apart into six. It's better than the... this is the one that was released late last year. It's better than the one that was released that Josh Whedon did in 2017. Let me just say that, even though it's longer. And there's only 15 minutes or so of material that is common between the two versions.
Oh, really? Good heavens.
You think about that. That's quite astounding. How much they must film and how much Whedon changed. It just changed a whole lot, basically, coming in later. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about movies that have been nominated for this year's Academy Awards. And as we speak and record today, I haven't, unfortunately, been able to avoid the fact that I now know who the winners were. So while I will start off and tell you what they were nominated, what each of these films was nominated for, I'll then tell you whether they won or not.
Okay.
And I'm quite safe to say that I picked the big three, basically. So that was okay. So I've actually been going to the cinema, David, and watching movies in the cinema, which is quite okay. It's actually got to the point now where the start of the year you had to wear a face mask when you were there, but now that's changed very much in Melbourne, and we're going to be fine, and we are fine now. First one I want to talk about is Nomadland, directed by Chloe Zhao, featuring Frances McDormand and David Strathairn. This picked up a swag of nominations for Best Film, Best Actress, Best Direction, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Film Editing, and Best Cinematography. I'll tell you what it picked up when I get through to the end. And now, Frances McDormand, I keep wanting to put a T in this, I'm not sure why. Frances McDormand has won two previous Best Actress Awards at the Oscars for Fargo and for... Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which I loved. I thought it was a fantastic film. Really, really excellent stuff. Fargo was also a great movie.
Yes.
She's now got to the point where she can pick and choose what she wants to do. And what she's done here is she's picked a film that, for a lot of people, is not really a film that they are going to like very much. It's essentially plotless. It doesn't start out to tell a three-act story. Its aim is to give you a slice of life for this character that Frances McDormand plays over the period of a year. Now, she starts off living in a small town of Empire. This small town is a sort of a company town that is basically everybody works at the US gypsum plant, but it shuts down. And shortly thereafter, Frances McDormand's character, who's known as Fern's husband dies of cancer. So she's left with basically nothing. And then the town pretty much disappears to the extent that the postal service takes its postcode back from it.
Oh, good heavens.
Basically just ceases to exist, and pretty much everybody moves out. She's left with practically nothing except a camper van and some of her and just her belongings. So she packs up everything into the camper van and decides that she's basically going to hit the road because there's nothing else for her. All of her friends have gone, her husband's dead, she's got nothing really much to look forward to. And so she starts doing odd jobs across the country, starting off doing some seasonal work in probably around Christmas, so they don't really say that, they just say it's seasonal work, at an Amazon fulfillment factory, is a distribution factory. So she's working, packing boxes and sending them out. So then she just basically roams the Midwest of the US in a van, taking piecework wherever she can get it, meeting up with people on the road. And she sort of almost reconnects with her sister, goes to see them at one stage, but it doesn't work out, and she decides to go back on the road again. Although they all want her to settle down, she doesn't really want to. And she almost falls into a relationship with Dave, who's David Strathairn, who's also on the road doing something similar. In fact, she meets up with a large number of people over the journey for the year who are doing the same type of thing that she's doing. Now, the interesting thing about this particular film is that the only two actors in it are those two that I've mentioned. All the rest of them are real life people that have been co-opted into helping make this particular film. And so the people you meet on the road are themselves. It's told in a sort of a documentary style, it's basically an examination of current America and how it's allowed these people who are our age, basically, David, to fall through the cracks. These are the people that basically have no safety net. There's no social security safety net for these people at all. And they just left and they're destitute and they have no idea what to do. And so they just put everything together and just move around. A lot of them actually get to the point where they enjoy it, but it is not an easy life. And I think somebody says to her at one stage, "Oh, you're homeless." She said, No. I'm not homeless. I just don't have a home. There's a difference. I'm not homeless. I have my van and I have people that I know and I meet up with them. And she keeps meeting up with the same people all the way through this. Now, I put a note on a small capsule review I did for something else that I could see why my 25-year-old self, if it was at that point, had gone to see this. I would have hated it.
Yes.
But my 65-year-old self loved it. I thought it was absolutely excellent.
It does sound good.
It is a tremendous film. A bit emotional. You're going to see Frances McDormand playing a very, very tough role. You'll see her cleaning her teeth, taking a piss by the side of the road, floating naked down a stream, and even taking a dump in a bucket. This is a tough role that she's done with little or no makeup, and it's all as natural as it possibly could be. You can't think of anybody else that would have been able to play this part, and she does it absolutely brilliantly. The film was nominated for 6 Academy Awards. And you know when I said that my 25-year-old self wouldn't have liked it? Well, my 22-year-old son went to see it and he came back and said, didn't like it at all. Wasn't a film for him. Wasn't a film for him. And anyway, so this film has done very, very well at today's Academy Awards ceremony. It won Best Film, Best Director. So Zhao becomes the first woman of colour and only the second woman ever to win this particular award. She's a Chinese director who's got into Hollywood and sort of doing this. So she and McDormand helped produce the film as well, and it looks like they basically got the whole thing together. McDormand won Best Actress, so she's now won 3. So there's only... I think Katharine Hepburn won 4, and I think there's only a couple, three or four others that have won 3 Best Actor or Actress awards. So she's up there in the stratosphere, basically. I have said at various times I would watch her folding her laundry, and I have done that now, and I'm very happy of it. And I'll go and see her folding her laundry again because she acts it so well. It's just worthwhile going to see. I gave this one 4.7 out of 5. Basically, it's, I cannot see when I saw this film, I thought that I could not see that anybody else would be able to be an actor, an actress in a main role in a film that would do better than this. It's just wonderful. But be aware of the fact that if you're looking for a story that's going to start, have a dramatic push all the way right through it, this is not going to be the film for you. She ends up back at the Amazon Fulfillment Center at the end of the film, and it's like, here we go again, another year. Mm. But I thought it was excellent.
Mm. It does sound good. All right. Well, at the risk of boring you all, I'm going to talk very briefly again about The Flash. I've already talked at length about the season five, so don't despair. I won't take long. I just want to have a rant.
That's good. Not the rant, but too much for
about too much. No. It's a rant about the annoying thing which the producers do with all these DC Comics properties on TV, and that's that they have what they call crossover events. So as well as the Flash series, Warner Brothers also produced a whole lot of other series based on other superheroes from the DC stable. The Flash series actually began as a couple of episodes of the Arrow series, in which Barry Allen appeared first as a crime scene investigator. So there were strong ties between the characters in each of these two series, The Flash and The Arrow, right from the start. And throughout all of the seasons of The Flash that I've watched, there would generally be one or two of these crossover episodes in which the two sets of characters get together for some kind of adventure or crisis. And that's all very well if these episodes are self-contained, so that you can just watch that one episode, which hopefully doesn't delay the main storyline being told in the whole season. The problem is that the producers seem to expect that you are obsessively watching both series in real time, that is, you know, as the shows are being aired on free-to-air TV. And so they have a number of these crossover things where to follow the story, you've got to watch one or more episodes in the other series as well. Now, maybe that works if you're glued to the TV, you know, watching them as they come out. But when you're trying to follow along with just a single series on a borrowed DVD from the library, it's infuriating to come upon an episode in which critical things occur. And really, in order to understand what's going on, you have to try and track down DVD of the other series to try and find the associated episode over there. And it's not just The Flash and Arrow which are involved. DC and Warner Brothers also produce TV versions of Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, Batwoman, and a whole lot of other spin-offs like Krypton and Black Lightning. And season 6 of The Flash, this comes to an infuriating climax with the storyline Crisis on Infinite Earths. Now, right from the earliest seasons of The Flash, we've been made aware of the fact that there's some impending crisis in Barry Allen's future in which he'll disappear, never to return. It's this disappearance which is what prompts Barry and Iris' daughter Nora to travel back from the future, as I mentioned just before. Well, this major crisis happens right in the middle of season 6 of The Flash. Is all of this important story on the DVD of season 6 of The Flash? No way. In order to follow the storyline of Crisis of Infinite Earths, you have had to have been watching all of the individual DC and Warner Brothers series on TV. 5 different series! Because Crisis on Infinite Earths starts in the Supergirl series, moves to the Batwoman series, then to The Flash, then to The Arrow, and finally concludes in the Legends of Tomorrow series. You'd have to track down all the relevant episodes in all 5 series to make any sense of the story. And what's more, this crisis is absolutely critical to understanding what's going to follow in each of these individual TV series. The whole universe of all these stories is shaken up in a big way, so you can't simply ignore it and move on. At this stage, I sort of just throw up my hands in disgust. But now, maybe eventually I'll track down all of the relevant episodes of all the series involved and work my way through, but it's certainly testing my resolve and interest. You might say that all this is just froth and bubble and it's juvenile comic book stuff and who cares, but I do care about storytelling, and this seems to me to be a very bad way to tell a story. So that's my rant. And that's enough of The Flash. I'm not going to talk about The Flash anymore.
This sounds very reminiscent of what they used to do in the actual comics themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And so the whole idea there is a marketing ploy to basically make sure that, you know, if you weren't a reader of Green Lantern and Green Arrow, but you were a reader of The Flash, if The Flash turned up in the other one, you had to basically go and buy the comic books,
that's right.
And then with the aim then of sort of thinking, well, if the reader has picked up the other title, there's a chance that they will subscribe to that and keep on reading that one all the way right through. Therefore, they'll increase their market share.
Yeah.
But yes, I can understand it's, you know, you're better off doing this as sort of a mini-series specific thing that goes off to one side and, you know, is just basically done as a 6 or 8 part thing where everybody's involved in it and then they move back. And it's almost like this happened over here and then we've got to jump back to our TV series and then carry on.
Yeah.
But they don't want to do that because of the marketing arrangement, which is always a bloody nuisance. But you can see what they're doing. I can certainly understand your frustration, David.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Well, there you are. That's it. I will not talk about The Flash anymore on the podcast.
Well, you can if you get to the next season, next one down the track.
Well, that's interesting enough. Yeah, we'll see.
Well, Well, it might pick up. You never know. So it might do well. On back to another Oscar-nominated film, The Father, directed by Florian Zeller, featuring Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman. I think everybody should know who basically Olivia Colman is and who Anthony Hopkins is, who both of them are really major actors on the British scene. This film was originally a French play, so it was a play in France, in French. When Florian Zeller, who had written the original play, based on people that he knew, he decided to do it in English. He collaborated with his long-term translator, Christopher Hampton, and they changed the name of the lead character from Andre to Anthony because Zeller had, in particular, wanted Anthony Hopkins to play this particular role, and you'll understand why when it comes up. He actually changes the name of the character from Andre to Anthony, and he also changes a line in the film from the play to change the birth date of the main character to the birth date of Anthony Hopkins. So he pitched this to Anthony. The story goes that he did the translation. He had no way of contacting Hopkins, didn't know, but he didn't know his agent, so he just sent it to him off out of the blue. He must have got his email address or something and sent it to him. Hopkins got it, read it, got back in contact with him and said, "I have to do this." Now, that's always a good thing, that if Anthony Hopkins is going to say he has to do the film, and when you hear that, you think, "Oh, okay, so this might be pretty good." Now, for the particular film itself, Anthony Hopkins plays Anthony, as I said, a man in his early 80s who was determined not to be moved out of his flat in London. And coincidentally, I figured out that this particular flat was around the corner from where my wife and I lived in Maida Vale in the early 1990s. So that was interesting. We looked at something, oh, that looks familiar. And then we went to check it up afterwards on Google Maps. And, oh, yes, there it is. Good thing about Google Maps. So Anthony doesn't want to leave his flat. But his daughter Anne, played by Olivia Colman, has a different view and tries to persuade him to move in with her and her husband. But does she actually have a husband? In one scene, she turns up talking to her father, and in another scene, another actress turns up saying that she's Anne, because he says, "Where's Anne?" "Well, I'm Anne." And it's a completely different character. Looks almost like, a younger sister. And for a while, I thought, oh, has he got sisters mixed up here? What's going on? And then you find out that there's a couple of people so does Anne have a husband? Is he played by this character, Rufus Sewell? Or is he, was he played by the actor Rufus Sewell? Or is he played by Mark Gatiss, both of whom appear in this particular film? And then there's a story about, is she staying in London or is she moving to Paris? Is he going to move in with her, or is he they're going to try and find him a spot somewhere else? Who are these people and what the heck is going on? And you suddenly also start noticing that things in the apartment, because the bulk of the film is filmed inside an apartment, so it's obviously a set on a theatre stage. Things start moving around. That wasn't there. There's a chess set here, and that chess set's now gone. And why is the colour of that wall changing? The door looks different. Why is the door looking different from where it was before? Now, obviously, Anthony's obvious encroaching dementia means that he's messing all these bits and pieces up. He's got bits from one scene, bits from another, characters here, characters there, and he's laying them all over the top of each other. And he really doesn't know. And neither does the audience what the real story is. So characters change, relationships change. There's a lot of subtle blink and you miss it stuff going on here, the film uses a lot of mystery techniques. It almost becomes, for you as the audience participant, trying to work out what is going on from all the clues that are given to you. But the clues are there, and then suddenly, well, hang on, this doesn't make any sense from the clue that was just over there. What's going on, and why has all this stuff changed? It's phenomenally interesting. Although it's just a small set, the acting is astonishing. Anthony Hopkins is just superb in this particular role. He's spoken about the fact how he took some time to get into it, but then he decided that he was going to channel his father and what his father went through while he was going through dementia. He was astonishing, and I had picked him pretty much straight away. I said, oh, look, if there's a better actor this year, I'd go he. I really didn't think there was going to be one. And I thought Olivia Colman was brilliant as the best supporting actress here, but anyway, we'll get to those in a minute. So in the end, you have to ask yourself, is this Hopkins' best film performance ever? Probably it is. But I should mention that before we get to the end, although it sort of comes across as a mystery, and it is, things do come together right in the last few minutes. You suddenly go, oh, that's what's been going on. So you're not going to get left hanging with this. It's not just going to wander off and go, oh, well, you know, I didn't know what was going on. It was a terrible film and they didn't tell us. This will give it to you. It won't lay it out on a platter for you. You have to figure it out. But all of the major clues are there, and you get to see what has gone on, and you get to figure it out. This is one I'll definitely go back and watch again, because I want to watch what Hopkins does, and I want to watch what happens to the apartment and pay closer attention to what's going on in the actual apartment itself. So I gave this 4.6 out of 5. I gave it just a touch under Nomadland, because I thought Nomadland was a bit better. And as I said, Nomadland won Best Film. This was nominated for Best Film. It was nominated for Best Actor, Best Supporting Actress for Colman, Best Adapted Screenplay by Christopher Hampton and Zeller, Best Film Editing, and Best Production Design. And today it won for Best Actor for Hopkins, and that's his second. Do you know what his first one was for?
Science of the Lambs, maybe?
That's the one that he got it for. And you think about that one. A lot of people have said that Hopkins has a tendency to walk through his roles a bit and just sort of, you know, post them in. He doesn't with this one. He doesn't with this one. He goes right down to the very depths of things. And he had to have a lot of faith in the director and the script in order to be able to get where he gets to in the end. And it's really quite excellent. Mm. And it also won for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Okay, great.
Heartily recommended. If you're going to see two films this year, go and see Nomadland and The Father.
Those sound like the ones, yeah. Mm.
However, if you go to The Father, take a box of tissues. It's very emotional and you will probably cry. I know I did.
Oh, that sounds very good. All right, what have I got next? Again, so slightly scraping the barrel because I watched so little. So I'm going to talk about Troll Bridge, which is a short film. It's only half an hour long. And it's based on a short story of that title by Terry Pratchett. Now, if you're a Terry Pratchett fan, you'll know all about the background here. But if you haven't discovered Pratchett yet, I'm not sure what I can say, except that you're missing a treat. So Pratchett sets his stories, just a bit of background for people who haven't read Pratchett, he sets his stories on a place called the Discworld, a flat disc-shaped world which has got continents and seas, which travels through space supported on the back of four gigantic elephants, each of whom stand on the shell of the great turtle Atuin swimming through space. So it's absurd. Yeah, okay. But Pratchett peoples this world with humans, witches, wizards, dwarves, elves, trolls, and other fantastical creatures. Now, if you're not into Pratchett, you're probably rolling your eyes right now, but it's what Pratchett does with this scenario and these sets of characters which is important. He uses them to makes very pointed observations about the real world and real-life human society, and he's very, very funny doing it. Anyway, Trollbridge is based on Pratchett's character, Cohen the Barbarian. This name, of course, is a funny spin on Robert E. Howard's muscle-bound hero, Conan the Barbarian. So Cohen the Barbarian is a hero in exactly the same mode as Howard's hero, except that he's old, very old. Pratchett has lots of fun imagining the fate of such a barbarian hero once he's past his use-by date, but he's still determined to live the hero lifestyle. And the simple story of Troll Bridge is that Cohen is determined to fulfill his last ambition, which is to go face-to-face in combat with a troll. Trolls in Pratchett's universe are silicon-based lifestyle. They're walking rocks, if you like. So they're pretty tough to defeat. So Cohen sets off for a troll bridge he's heard about in the mountains. He's accompanied by a horse he bought, or probably stole, from a wizard, and it's a talking horse. So there's lots of funny banter between the two as they head off into the mountains. And the film of this, the short film of this story, was shot on the South Island of New Zealand. So you get some spectacular shots of Cohen leading his horse across these snowy, mountainous landscapes, clad only in loincloth, eye patch, and assorted weaponry. Cohen's played by someone called Don Bridges. I don't know if he's an actor, but he plays a very convincing aged Cohen, equipped with a set of false teeth made from diamonds he stole from a troll. So Cohen eventually reaches this troll bridge, under which, of course, lives a troll, ready to challenge anyone daring to cross. And he calls out the troll, who duly responds. But before the conflict really begins, the fearsome-looking troll discovers that he's facing Cohen the Barbarian, the famous Cohen the Barbarian. And the troll is overwhelmed with joy that Cohen has decided to visit his bridge. So he trots off and he brings back his troll wife and son so that they too can see this famous hero. And the troll wife and son aren't very impressed by this, and they soon scoot off and they leave the troll and Cohen to stand around talking gloomily about the good old days and how everything's changed for the worse. It's a lot of fun. Anyway, I should say that this film was funded by a Kickstarter project. Now, it took quite a while to get made and released. The Kickstarter project began in 2011, but the film didn't premiere until January 2019 at Flickerfest in Sydney, and it was released to general distribution in November 2019. And it's now available for free on YouTube, and I'll put a link in the show notes. One thing I wanted to say, though, because it illustrates why my wife and I don't go out to see movies in the theatre, and that's that when we first watched it, I couldn't work out how to get the English subtitles to show up. Instead, I got Arabic subtitles, which weren't much use. So we tried to watch it without the subtitles, and that didn't work out very well for either, as we really are both becoming quite deaf. And it's made more difficult in this film by not being able to really being able to lip-read Cohen, because he's got this mouthful of diamond false teeth. And we couldn't obviously read the lips of the animated troll either. So we struggled through it, sort of, but we knew that we were missing a lot. Anyway, I went back, and after some experimentation, I was finally able to get the English subtitles. And we watched the whole thing again. It made much more sense to do watching it that time. So really, it just confirms that we're both now pretty totally dependent on closed captioning, which means we're stuck with DVDs or streaming services which do have subtitles, and going to the movies in the theatre is really just not something we can go ahead and do, unless it's a foreign film, I suppose, which has got the English subtitles for a foreign language. But that's about it. So that's my next little piece.
Okay, sounds interesting. I have to admit that Terry Pratchett's a bit of a blind spot for me. I've read a couple of pieces, and I just don't get it. So maybe this would be a good introduction, and I should go and have a look at it and see how it goes.
I do always recommend to people with Terry Pratchett not to read the first couple of books in the Discworld series.
Guess what I've read?
The first two books are actually not very good.
No.
I have to admit that. But he gets into his stride with a book called Mort, which is When Death Takes an Apprentice. It's a wonderful book. And then he goes on from there, and you discover the witches and so on. It's good stuff. But so the first couple of books are not a good introduction at all to the series. So you're probably best to start with something like Mort.
Right. Okay. Because I've read the first couple of books, and that's probably why I've got to the position that I'm in. So it's nice to be able to get a pointer about where to start with things. I suppose once you've read further on down into the series, you can go back and read the first two, and it isn't going to colour your understanding or your feelings about the rest of the series, but it might provide some background information about things.
That's true. Yeah.
Because I remember the first one, The Colour of Magic, is basically a wizard with a suitcase with legs that just follows him around everywhere. Something that most travellers would like to be able to have if you can get them. And I believe that somebody's actually trying to develop something just like that. Anyway,
that'd be fun. Yeah,
everyone, it would be.
Yeah.
My next film is another one in the best film nominees for this year's Oscars. This one was not watched on in the cinema, but at home because it's on Netflix. And this one's called The Trial of the Chicago Seven, written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, who you will remember from West Wing
West Wing.
and other things. The film features actors Eddie Redmayne, Mark Rylance, Sacha Baron Cohen, who helped with the funding for this. He's Borat, and Frank Langella, who most people wouldn't want to list, but I have because I think he's absolutely wonderful in the role, and I'll explain why. Now, this picked up Oscar nominations for Best Film, Best Director, Best Screenplay by Sorkin, Best Supporting Actor for Cohen, and Best Original Song. I don't think it won any of them. So, but it's certainly worth your while watching this film. I actually went into this and I said to my wife, "Oh, I really don't feel like watching anything tonight. I don't, you know, I'm a bit tired. I think I'll just watch a bit, then I'll go to bed." Watch the whole thing straight through. A bit over 2 hours. Got engrossed in it. Really liked it. Couldn't just carried on. So it was able to lift me up out of a feeling of, you know, maybe I don't really want to watch this, to actually enjoying it quite a lot.
Good.
Now, it follows the trial of the seven men accused of conspiring to cause riots in Chicago at the time of the Democratic Convention in 1968. This is at the time of a very, well, I think Walter Cronkite, who's there in the particular, he gets a, well, they have a snippet of him from the TV, where he says that it's a convention being held in a police state because Chicago was run by Mayor Daley, who was probably pretty much as corrupt as the day was long. And, you know, he just was doing the bidding of everybody around him. Richard Nixon was about due to be elected as president. So this Chicago Democratic Convention was to choose or to anoint the Democratic presidential candidate after Johnson had refused to stand. Now, there's a lot of material here. A lot of it is spent in the courtroom. So you get a lot of flashbacks about what was going on in terms of what happened during the riot and how it all sort of comes together. There's obviously a large wealth of material here because the trial went on for like 150 days or something, about 6 months. So massive amounts of material. But Sorkin has basically woven a sort of a very intricate, well-crafted 2 hour film out of all of this that hits all the high points of the drama. But I have to tell you that there is a side that is definitely taken here. Sorkin is on the side of the defendants in this particular case, and once you watch it, you'll understand why. The trial judge, played by Frank Langella, is an oaf and a bully. They've got all seven together, pitched there together as a conspiracy, and they also have a member of the Black Panthers who was only in town for 4 hours one day to deliver a speech. And the 4 hours were, had to go from the airport to the place, deliver the speech, go back, sit and wait, and then leave. And so he was really only in anywhere where he considered to be part of the conspiracy. He was only there for an hour. Now he's got a different lawyer from the others. The main defense lawyer is played by Mark Rylance, who's a major theater actor from Britain. He does an excellent job here. So the Black Panther defendant, his lawyer is sick, unable to attend. I mean, you think he's having a gallbladder operation. So it's not as if so he's in hospital. It's not as if he's, oh, you know, I don't feel well, I'm not going to turn up. But the judge basically says, well, you have to be, you have to take the lawyer over here, the one that played by Mark Rylance. And Rylance says, well, no, I've got enough to do. I can't look after him as well. And the guy from Black Panther says, no, he's not my lawyer. So they just carry on. The Black Panther guy, all the way through this, keeps on saying, I'm not being represented. I am not, you know, I don't have any representation here. My rights are being infringed. In the end, the judge basically gets the sheriffs to take the guy out the back, beat him up, gag him and handcuff him, and then bring him back. And then he says to him, you can just nod your head or shake your head. Are you, if I let you out of these constraints, are you going to continue to interrupt? Oh, does he say? I think he said, "Are you going to stop interrupting?" And he just shakes his head. No. And in the end, it's quite obvious that this guy has been set up, and the whole thing's being a setup. In the end, the judge calls a mistrial for the Black Panther guy, so he's allowed to leave, and he is going to be tried at another time. And all the rest of them basically have to work their way through this whole sham. It's a political trial. They call it a political trial, even though the prosecution said, well, there's no such thing as a political trial in America. So it's obviously set in 1968. It's a time when the world was watching, as they say, what was going on in Chicago. And it was just bloody awful. I mean, these were people that had not set out to riot. They were just trying to peacefully demonstrate. But it was in 1968 when they were demonstrating against the Vietnam War, not wanting that to continue. And of course, that was against what everybody in the government and the military industrial complex in America wanted. And so there was pressure brought from on high to convict these guys, and they were convicted. They were each sentenced to 5 years in prison. This is not giving anything away because this is part of history.
No, it's history.
Yeah, so they were sentenced for 5 years in prison. They appealed. The Justice Department overthrew the original conviction and then refused to retry them. So even they knew it was a sham. Yeah. And it had been so, the whole process had been so embarrassing to everybody because of how bad it was that they just had to let it go. But the reason why I brought up Frank Langella, who plays the judge here, is that it's actually difficult for an intelligent actor to play somebody so bloody stupid, yeah. But do it in a manner that is just so convincing. And you think, you get to the point at the end of the film where you hate him and you think, this guy's done such a wonderful job. But he wasn't, I thought he was stunning in the role, and I thought that he should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actor. But, of course, he's not the hero of the part. And the Academy doesn't like people that play bad guys normally. They like people that play good guys. And he isn't the good guy. I'd recommend this. I gave it 4.4 out of 5. It's on Netflix. If you have that streaming service, sit down one night and watch it. You really enjoy it.
Okay. Thanks for that. I don't have Netflix at the moment, but I'm probably resubscribe one of these days, so I'll put that on the list.
I think there's enough on it. And, you know, what is it, $10 a month or whatever it is? It's not really overly whatever it is. It's not that bad, and there's a lot of good stuff on it.
Yeah, it's not the money, it's the fact that I have very little time to watch.
So it's really going to be money going out that you're not actually going to spend. It's a bit like magazine subscriptions where they keep turning up, and they keep piling up, and you think, I must get to those at some stage. And after you've got about 8 or 10 of them piled up, unopened, you think, maybe it's time for me to stop this subscription.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so I'm going to talk about a film which I saw on Amazon Prime. So that is the one service I do currently subscribe to, Amazon Prime. There's some good stuff on there too. And this is a film called The Current War. What it is it's a dramatized study of the real-life rivalry between major figures who were involved in the development of electrical power generation and distribution in America in the late 1800s. It features Benedict Cumberbatch as Thomas Alva Edison and Michael Shannon as his bitter rival, George Westinghouse, and also stars Nicholas Hoult as Nikola Tesla. It also has Tom Holland as Edison's secretary. And Tom Holland seems to be everywhere these days, from playing Spider-Man to being in Apple TV's new series, Cherry. He's everywhere. You see him in a lot of movies, trailers anyway. Now, Thomas Edison doesn't come off as a very sympathetic figure in this movie. He is portrayed as being very stubborn, and he's willing to compromise his principles and the truth in order to gain a commercial advantage. He's very much focused on making money. So the year is 1880, and Edison has just developed the first successful electric light bulb that doesn't, you know, sort of burn out in 2 seconds flat. And in order to sell these bulbs, he needs to generate and distribute electricity to every household or office, which obviously to them, so that they can actually use this new form of light. Now, his system to do this is based on direct current. I think it's basically charging up a thunder great battery and distributing it through the wires. So the businessman and inventor George Westinghouse is interested in working with Edison at this point, and Westinghouse invites Edison and his family to dinner one evening. Now, Edison and his family are traveling from New York on their private train. There's a lot of use of private trains in this movie. It's really kind of hard to get your head around the fact that people used to have these private trains. You had to be pretty rich, I suppose, but they're thundering around on the rail system in their own very own trains. But anyway, as they come along towards the station where Westinghouse and his wife are waiting in the cold to meet them, to take them to dinner, Edison orders the train to continue and not stop because he says his children are tired and he himself, it's pretty clear that he himself doesn't really have the patience to work with other inventors. And so the train thunders on by and Westinghouse and his wife are sort of staring at this train as it goes by. So obviously they feel that they've been really rudely snubbed, and Westinghouse sets out to build his own system, which is based on alternating current, which he's convinced can be transmitted with less power over greater distances. And so this is the current war over the type of electrical current. That's how it begins. And then we have Nikola Tesla, who comes to the United States and he works for a short time for Edison based on a promise of a large financial reward. But eventually he breaks with Edison when he can't get Edison to change his mind about the type of current to be used. And when Tesla asks Edison for the promised reward, which is $50,000 or something, Edison just waves it off, saying it was just a joke. It's absurd. He's not going to give him any money. And so Tesla's really, really totally pissed off. And it's Tesla who eventually comes up with a system for running motors safely using alternating current, which up to that time was a crucial flaw in Westinghouse's system. So really Tesla made Westinghouse's system sort of viable thing for factories and so on. For anything other than just lighting up electric light bulbs. But Edison just doubles down on this idea of direct current, and he starts a media campaign suggesting that alternating current is highly dangerous, lethal. And as part of this campaign, he demonstrates to a group of the press a horse being electrocuted by alternating current. You know, see how lethal this thing is. We could just kill a horse with it. But the problem with that is that it leads to ideas by the prison authorities that electrocution would be a humane method of execution of condemned prisoners. Now, Edison eventually, after being persuaded a fair bit, secretly starts to help with advice to the authorities to push this idea forward, because he believes it will convince people that alternating current is indeed too dangerous to have in their homes. You know, they use it to kill people. But the first such execution of a human being, however, using this method is a terrible, crudely botched event. It's almost a form of torture. And eventually Edison's involvement comes out, is released, is leaked to the press. And this terribly harms his reputation and it sort of blunts his campaign against AC power. Look, I enjoyed this film a lot. It's a really interesting true story and it's very well dramatized here. I should probably say that the version I was watching was the director's cut, which was released in 2019. The director was Alfonso Gomez Rayon, and apparently the version which was originally produced and shown at the Toronto Film Festival in 2017 didn't get very good reviews at all. And subsequently, Gomez Rayon reshot some scenes and cut 10 minutes away from the original release to make this particular movie, which did better in terms of people's ratings of it. So, yeah, I liked this quite a bit. It was good.
Okay. That's one that I've seen floating around and thought, well, whenever Mr. Cumberbatch is in something, it's always worthwhile wandering along and having a bit of a look.
It is, yeah. He does a good job, I think.
Yes, I think you might sort of say, well, you know, aren't these guys in everything? But no, they're not. I think they can, if you get to the certain point, a bit like Frances McDormand, you can pick and choose. And Anthony Hopkins, you can pick and choose as to what you're going to appear in. That's good, and it basically means that there's they're picking the eye teeth out of everything, and you're going to get the good stuff.
Yeah.
My last film is another one nominated for the best film at this year's Academy Awards, and it's called Mank, directed by David Fincher, from a screenplay written by his late father. So his father had written this particular screenplay for this film, and it had been languishing because nobody wanted to make it. And then David Fincher, who's a well-known director in Hollywood, decided that he would do it himself. It features Gary Oldman in the lead role. The Mank of the title is Joseph Mankiewicz. Herman Mankiewicz. So Joseph was his younger brother. Sorry, I get it mixed up. Anyway, so he's the Mank of the film's title. The film basically concerns the writing of the screenplay of Orson Welles' film Citizen Kane, which was mainly written by Herman Mankiewicz, with some work done by Orson Welles, although Welles liked to say that he was the one that did the bulk of the work. This is written to show you that, no, he did not do the bulk of the work, and most of it was done by Mank. I have to admit, the film does start pretty well, as Mank, who's swathed in plaster after up to his hip, after he's been in a car accident, is ensconced in a country house in California somewhere and given 90 days originally, and then Welles rings him up and says, no, let's do it in 60. You know, isn't that great? You know, I want you to write a film, which they really hadn't discussed very much up until then. So I don't know what the arrangements were going to be in terms of what the subject matter was. But anyway, Mankiewicz is in this house writing the screenplay, and the interplay between him and his doctor and his help and his helpers promises this is going to be something interesting, that it's going to be quite a good film. And the story of how he came to be there and writing this particular screenplay is told in a series of flashbacks, but they start to become a bit repetitive, with a lot of extraneous scenes and lots of episodes of Mankiewicz walking up and down, pontificating to people and drinking a lot, and generally being a shit to just about everybody around him who can't appreciate his genius. Films about alcoholics have a tendency to be pretty tedious,
yes,
and they go on too much, and there's just, this one's no exception really in my view. There's some good scenes in it, mixed with some that have meant just declaiming, walking up and down declaiming to everybody. And, it's three things thought to when I was watching this. I thought it was overwritten, overblown, and overdone. It's just, there's too much of everything here. And it was just, it's just too much stuff. Oldman's good in the role. The thing looks really good, and it's shot in black and white, so that it sort of complements the idea of the way Welles made Citizen Kane. Some of the people playing the bit parts are really good, but overall, for me, it really just does not come together and doesn't fit. It won Oscars for Best Production Design and Best Cinematography after being nominated for Best Film Dressed, Best Film, Best Director, Best Supporting Actress, Best Sound, Best Original Music Score, Best Makeup and Hairstyling, Best Costume Design and Best Cinematography. I only gave it 2.8 out of 5. It's on Netflix. If you're really, a fan of film and how it was made in Hollywood, or if you're interested in how Citizen Kane came to be, then yes, I would suggest that you watch this. I won't be watching it again. I don't, there's nothing here that really holds my interest, to be perfectly frank, even though I do like Citizen Kane. Sorry, not for me, this one.
Fair enough. And Gary Oldman's another one of those people who's in a heck of a lot of films, isn't he? He's a very good actor.
He is a very good actor. He won an Academy Award a few years ago for playing Winston Churchill. He did a very good. He was very good in that role. He's excellent in this particular role. It's just that I don't like the story. I don't. Having guys drinking all the time and then throwing up and, in the end, you just basically think, come on, not another drinking bout. Do we have to go through this yet again? And yes, we do, to get to the other side. And I wasn't overly interested in that beyond its initial concept, really.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep.
All right, well, I think we've covered all of that. We'll look forward to our next episode, which I think we're going to do another Hugo Time Machine, is that right?
Yes, the 1966 Hugo Awards for works that were published in 1965. A major year in that it was also the first year that the Nebula Awards were presented as well. So we'll be crossing over and having a look, a bit of a look at those, not digging into that as much detail as Hugo, so we'll explain why when that comes up next time. But we've got a bit of reading to do, and
Yes, yeah, we'll manage.
yeah, I think we'll get there. We'll get there. All right, David, thanks very much.
Excellent. So see you in a couple of weeks.
Will do. See you later.
See you. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.